Dave Mack's Cork History Matters, brought to you by Red FM.
I'm Dave McCardle. This is the Cork History Matters podcast. I'm in the company once again of Gabriel Doherty of the UCC History Department. Gabriel, in episode one, we sketched out the story of Tomás McCurtain on the day of the 100th anniversary of his assassination by the RIC, one of the key episodes of a dramatic year in Ireland's history, 1920. We return to that particular point where the inquest comes into play for Tomás McCurtain. We covered this territory too in episode one, but you have subsequently been reading more on this, and you see this as something that it was arguably the first thing that caught the world's attention, what was happening in Ireland.
Up until this point, there had been events bubbling away under the surface, as it were, in Ireland. In particular, the IRA was arming itself. Usually relatively small-scale operations like attacks on houses, civilian houses, where they believed that weapons were being stored, or simply purchasing them off soldiers. Small-scale operations. In early 1920, then, they started ramping up their attack on the RIC. Initially, this had been peaceful, particularly boycotting the RIC and their families, but the increasingly became violent. Initially, again, this violence was directed more against the buildings of the RIC rather than the individuals. But of course, one should remember that earlier on in the evening that Tomás McCurtain was shot, an RIC man had been shot dead in Cork City. So lethal attacks on the police had begun. But it's his assassination which really is a game changer. It's a wake up call, not just in Ireland or in the United Kingdom, but internationally, that something very, very serious is happening in Ireland. You have the first citizen of one of the largest cities in the country being shot dead, in effect, in his bed almost, certainly in his own house, by members of the very police force who are supposed to be protecting the citizenry. So it was a huge event, and certainly if one has a look at the coverage of this in the international press, this starts putting Ireland on the front page in a way that it had never been before. And it isn't just where we'd expect, perhaps in America or even perhaps in some of the European countries, in some Latin American countries, in Asian countries. Increasingly, journalists are starting to look at Ireland as one of the continuing trouble spots of Europe. There was a perception that everything had been resolved in Europe after the war, and the Versailles Conference had, in effect, put many of the problems to bed. It hadn't, certainly as far as Ireland was concerned. And then this the first sensation, which was the assassination of Lord Mayor McCurtain, is then followed by a second one, which is, well, on a daily basis, one has the release during the inquest of highly incriminating details as to what went on during the night. And this uniformly pointed towards the culpability of the police, even though the British tried to circulate a rumour that somehow it had been an inside job and that, as it were, the radical wing of the Republican movement had taken McCurtain out because he was seen to be a weak link. That simply wasn't true. But it's when the verdict of the inquest comes in, and this is a sensation. It names names, and it doesn't just name the individuals who were immediately involved, such as District Inspector Swansea, probably the best known name of the RIC. In effect, the verdict of the jury implicates the entire structure of government, British government in Ireland. It says that what killed Tomás McCurtain was British government in Ireland. And in particular, it names Lloyd George as being responsible for his death. We know for a fact that Lloyd George was aware of that and to a certain extent was a little sensitive to it. He tried to laugh it off to a certain extent, and the British tried to mock this verdict. But certainly in terms of the coverage that it received, again, globally, that started to, again, just further indicated that something was strange and something unusual and, to a large extent, unprecedented was happening in Ireland.
Dublin Castle would have called for the inquiry, so arguably...
It was mandatory. It was mandatory. I mean, an inquest had to be held where there was any unnatural deaths. But largely on foot of this verdict. And of course, remember that this had followed a number of other inquest decisions. Perhaps the most famous previous one had been on Thomas Ashe, the hunger striker back in 1917, which found that he had been killed by his treatment. It didn't expressly point the finger of blame at the government, but that was by dint of inference, whereas this verdict was very explicit and named names right the way through to the top of the tree. And so the scene is then set for the next stage in the drama, both locally here in Cork and nationally.
Does that inquest come out soon after?
It's about a month later. And that month is filled on a daily basis with very damning testimony from a whole series of individuals, some of whom were actually had some sort of connections with the regime, the British regime here. And long before the verdict itself was actually made public, it was pretty clear to anyone who'd been paying attention what the sequence of events had been. But to get that decision in such explicit terms was unprecedented.
And it wasn't a stacked inquiry.
No, absolutely not. I mean, the individuals who made up an inquest during those days, in effect, had to be ratepayers, had to be individuals whose standing in the community was such that you would almost automatically expect them to be more sympathetic to the British system of doing it than perhaps the Republican alternative. And some of the individuals were themselves came from unionist backgrounds. So to have that type of verdict from that type of pool of individuals, their social background, their political affiliations, was very, very damning. In one sense, one of the immediate casualties of that verdict was the inquest system itself, because the British simply decided, well, we're not going to have that this again. So they abandoned having public inquest juries, and these were then subsequently held under the auspices of the military. And of course, needless to say, no similar verdict was returned under that system. But of course, it's then who follows. I mean, we then have as the inquest was just getting going, Terence McSweeney was inaugurated as a successor.
And just to add a little social context, post-World War One, there's the Spanish flu outbreak globally, similar to the sort of COVID experience we've lived through here in Ireland in 2020 and globally too. Yep. Solo Head Beg in late 1919, where the RIC officers die, is seen as the first action. But some people look at the War of Independence beginning on January 2nd of 1920 with the RIC barracks attack in Carrigtool, which in effect chases the RIC back out of rural Cork and into the city.
Yes. And certainly, I mean, this was a policy that was pursued nationwide, but certainly had a peculiar intensity in Cork between Carrigtool and Kilmurry, where there was an unsuccessful attack on the same day.
So then the Lord Mayor is assassinated effectively in his bed, although on the landing, as witnessed by his son, Terence McSweeney is incorporated. And they were the two key figures in Cork rebel circles, let's say, as outlined in the last podcast. The inquest is ongoing, but interesting for me, and maybe this is the point to move forward from, is that 5 days after the murder of Tomás McCurtain, the first Black and Tans arrive in Ireland. And whilst standing on the platform in Limerick Junction are observed as looking something similar to the Scarteen Black and Tan hunt in County Tipperary. So moves were afoot even while inquest was over.
This was a legacy of the campaign against the RIC that had been ongoing since
they
the previous summer.
They were stripped of numbers.
Yeah, I mean, the RIC had been very much under the gun, if you'll pardon the expression, certainly in the crosshairs of both Sinn Féin and the IRA. Again, to repeat what I said earlier, initially this campaign was largely peaceful, albeit still very, very forceful, using the traditional methods of the boycott dating back to the times of the land war of the 1880s. And when this method hadn't proved as successful as perhaps some of the more radical thinkers within the Republicans had wished, then the game is upped. You start having attacks on the barracks, and then you start having lethal attacks on the police themselves. As you mentioned, these lethal attacks had begun already in 1919, most famously in Solihull Beg, but as part of a consistent, coordinated pattern, it really is 1920 when things really start hotting up.
And due to the defections in the RIC.
And so what happens is that there is a collapse in morale of the RIC. There is a number of causes. The first is simply the pressure that they're under, that they cannot leave their barracks without fear of attack. Their families are also intimidated. They are boycotted, shunned, sent to Coventry. Their wives, where they were married, that nobody would speak to their wives, nobody would speak to their children. And it became, for a job that had the reputation of being sort of a good, steady job, one with a relatively high wage, one where it had a high social standing in the community, you instantly become a pariah. And it became very, very difficult for many members of the RIC to stay with that. You also then had other pressures on the RIC. One of the problems that the government had was that it was tempting to make concessions, for example, to hunger strikers. So that in Mountjoy in March of 1920, there was a huge hunger strike, which lasted for well over 20 days. There were an equally big one in Wormwood Scrubs, prisoners who had been deported. And on both occasions, in effect, the government capitulated. They didn't want another Thomas Ashe on the hand. But of course, that further demoralised the members of the RIC, because having successfully arrested who they regarded as the culprits in their localities, it was galling to them to see those individuals being released. And then on the other hand, coming from above within the RIC, you start having pressure being put on the RIC to start adopting methods that many of the members of the RIC found utterly unacceptable. Perhaps most famous, of course, is the Listowel Mutiny, where a senior member of the RIC visits the local barracks and in effect tells the local members that they can shoot to kill. They can kill with impunity. If they saw somebody who they thought might be carrying a weapon, somebody even walking around with their hands in the pocket, in effect they're told expressly to shoot that person and to kill them. And they were told that you will not get into trouble if you shoot such a person, if you find yourself in that situation. And of course, many members of the RIC were horrified at that suggestion. I mean, as far as they were concerned, they weren't murderers. They were upholders of law and order, and that precluded that type of action. But it also meant is that they realised that this is what was going to be expected of them. On that particular occasion, of course, the RSA mutiny and in effect tell the officer who is English to get out of there very quickly, or he might find himself in a rather tricky situation. So that the pressure is on the RIC coming both from the Republican side and also from above. And many of the members of the RIC simply found this pressure unbearable. About half the members of the RIC resign during the course of 1920 through to 1921. Of course, the fact that they had been driven out of their barracks meant that, in one sense, less numbers are needed. But, of course, that merely served to prove the point of how dominant the IRA was across pretty well, certainly most of rural Cork, outside the towns. So it was a very difficult situation. Of course, then the British had to find some way to find the numbers that would be able to man even the reduced staffing that they had. So this is where the Black and Tans came in. I mean, the Black and Tans were largely ex-soldiers. They were encouraged to adopt, as it were, the same militaristic outlook on their deployment in Ireland as they had during their service in France or in Gallipoli or in Mesopotamia or elsewhere. They weren't given any meaningful training in terms of the law of Ireland or how to apply the law. It was very clear that they were there as a garrison, in effect as a de facto military garrison. And then secondly, this wasn't sufficient for the British because, of course, the Black and Tans, as the RSA had been largely static. They could cycle around and so on and so forth, but they weren't a strike force. So it's in this context that the British start now recruiting a new and even more troublesome force, the Auxiliary Division of the RIC, which are ex-officers, which are paid an exorbitant rate of £1 a day, famously. And the real distinctive feature of the auxiliaries was that they were intended to take the fight to the IRA, not just to sit there in their barracks or to be attacked while on patrol, but to do to the IRA what the IRA had been doing to the RIC, to ambush them, to hunt them down. And they are deployed later on in the summer. And the scene is set for a very, very rapid escalation in terms of the numbers of incidents and a deterioration in terms of conduct.
At the same time, civil disobedience is growing with Dublin dock workers refusing to handle British war material, yes, joined by railway. Yes. It's such a...
It's a heady brew. I mean, every element is joining in. Remember, even things like the suffragettes, many of the suffragettes who had been active in the movement, many of them, certainly those of a nationalist inclination, start joining in. Cum and Amman are exceptionally active in a number of fields. In many respects, they lead many of the demonstrations, for example, outside jails, precisely because they realise that the British couldn't be seen to be, for example, battening them away in the way that perhaps they wouldn't have shown such compunction when dealing with men. So, I mean, and as you say, there, the the trade union movement, even though there's a certain split within the trade union movement, because, of course, you do have unionist members of the trade union movement, particularly in industrial Belfast, many of those coming from a Protestant background. And so there was an element within the trade union movement that wasn't sympathetic to the Republican campaign. But by and large, certainly within, for example, the Transport and General Workers Union, Larkin's old union, that there was sympathy.
And this even spreads further afield to India.
Yes, absolutely. Much the same way as we've discussed the mutiny within the RIC in Ireland. You start having the dread prospect of the Irish contagion infecting other parts of the empire. Remember, of course, that India was itself already in turmoil. You'd had the horrific Amritsar massacre in 1919 when hundreds and hundreds of Indians had simply been shot dead in the most appalling massacre you can possibly imagine. Interestingly, one should remember that the general who gave the order to fire was educated in Middleton College, and the Governor General of India at the time, General Sir Michael Dwyer, was a Tipperary Catholic. So there were, as it were, the Irish on the other side as well. But certainly in terms of the impact that Ireland had on the empire, India is the best example. You do have soldiers within the Connaught Rangers who were in protest at what they see as the excesses inflicted particularly by the Black and Tans and the auxiliaries, but also to a certain extent by some of the things that the army itself had been doing. And you do have a number of those individuals who in fact are killed, executed. But it's not just there. You also have, as it were, the example of Republicans taking on the British, in British back door, on their doorstep, I should say. And for the Indian point of view, the fact that they were so distant, it means that the British are occupied. The British had to withdraw troops from India in order to hold them in reserve for Ireland. And B, it also served an example that you could take the British on. They weren't invincible. But you also have methods. Again, I suppose here we come back to Cork and Terence McSweeney's hunger strike. He absolutely had an influence upon Mahatma Gandhi in terms of his use of the hunger strike, as it were, a non-violent form of protest. Terence McSweeney
had been influenced by Thomas Ashe.
There had been this report. The thing is about McSweeney is that he was the first one to die, as it were, of hunger. Ashe had died as a result of being force-fed after a relatively few days on hunger strike, whereas McSweeney lasts over 70 days and is brutal. And that really, it doesn't just make the headline news internationally on one day or 2 days. This is week upon week upon week. I'm studying this just at the moment. If you have a look at the leading American newspaper, something like the New York Times, the McSweeney hunger strike is basically on that front page pretty well every day. Well, maybe 2 out of 3 days during the entire duration of the hunger strike. Now, that's the leading newspaper, as it were, in America, is having this story. It is the global news story of autumn 1920, outdoing even things like, let's say, the Russian invasion of Poland and the fear that Bolshevism was about to spread over Western Europe. Even that had to play second fiddle to McSweeney. It's also important to remember, of course, that the hunger strike itself affected America directly. There were a number of strikes in America where initially Irish longshoremen and dock workers refused to handle British goods and not just goods, but refused to allow ships to dock, even liners. And by degrees, other nationalities who were also working in those docks also joined in the protest.
And as you pointed out in the first podcast, the Irish factor had already had a major influence in American politics with Woodrow Wilson, who'd gone to the League of Nations in Versailles with this sense of, you know, freedom for people to express their right to nationhood, which doesn't happen in the case of Ireland as a result of David Lloyd George's intransigence.
Yes,
and this causes him to lose the Irish-American vote in America, lose the next election and bring in America first.
Wilson has basically a breakdown. It's at this stage impossible to know exactly whether it's a physical breakdown, a mental breakdown or one of the both. But he doesn't contest the presidential election in 1920. But you do have a presidential election in 1920. And the Irish question is part of that. The Irish do try to get commitments from both parties. Harding and Cox to make a commitment towards Irish self-government. Both refused to do so, but certainly in terms of the timing of the McSweeney hunger strike, which is in the autumn of 1920, only a couple of months before the vote itself is taken. This adds to the dynamic mix and the very fluid mix in way in which the Irish question was impacting upon American politics. Remember, of course, you also have De Valera there, who'd been there midway through 1919. He's starting to have extreme problems, however, at this point in terms of running into conflict with some senior figures within Irish America. But certainly it was the autumn of 1920 is when things really start coalescing.
So when we told the story of Tomás McCurtain last time round, it seemed to sort of, McSweeney and McCurtain, it felt to me, as you described it, that they mirrored each other as individuals and in their rise through the history, so to speak. McSweeney replaces McCurtain as Lord Mayor of Cork. Mm. Were they similar characters? And, you know, he seems, like, obviously, having died on hunger strike, he's clearly a very principled man.
But even
the words he uses. Yeah. So he's trumped up charges of treason, is what he's charged with, as the Lord, the Sinn Féin Lord Mayor of Cork. And he says something as he comes out. I'll be free in a week, either released or dead. Yep. Is that it? Something to that effect.
Well, in the month he said, I'll decide my freedom. And said, I'm going on a hunger strike. So you'll either release me because of what I'm doing, or I will die through my own actions. But one way or the other, I'm in charge. You may put me in prison, but I control you by my action. It's one of those curious, as well, inversions of power that happened during the hunger strike. To come back to your question in terms of the connections between the two men, there's sometimes a rather sort of hackneyed attempt to depict the two men as sort of almost polar opposites, that McCurtain is the pragmatist, McSweeney is the airy dreamer and philosopher. They shared far more in common than what differentiated them. In particular, both were absolutely committed to the Irish language. I mean, the Gaelic League had been probably the first point of contact for both in terms of their exploration of the wider realm of Irish language. Both were involved in industrial development. McCurtain, perhaps more famously. But McSweeney certainly, I mean, what is often forgotten, McSweeney, his day job for many years was basically a teacher of accountancy. So he wasn't somebody who was oblivious to business. I mean, that's where he earned his daily crust. Both, of course, were very heavily involved in the Irish Volunteers once it started. Both were traumatised by what had happened or not happened in 1916. So in terms of their outlook, there was differences. Perhaps it's probably fair to say that McSweeney was more involved in the arts. I mean, he was a poet, he was a dramatist, very heavily involved in the art scene here in Cork. I think slightly wry grin on my face here. It's partly, I think, because he was single at the time and he didn't have the family commitments that Tomás McCurtain may have done. So,
but they were the one and two in Cork.
Yes, absolutely.
In terms of
But one and two both on the political side within Sinn Féin, and one and two on the military side within the Irish Volunteers.
Did he spend time in Frangach as well?
I just have to check now whether it's in Frangach, but he spends, as a large number of them do, including Tomás McCurtain, a number of times in a variety of different jails and prison camps between basically 1916 and 1919. They see the insides of many convict prisons as well as prison camps. So McSweeney he wrote a number of columns in newspapers. He actually founded his own newspaper, Fianna Fáil, in Cork in the autumn of 1914. And it's an extremely interesting read. In terms of his commentary on what was happening at the outbreak of the war, the action of John Redmond in supporting the war, and so on and so forth. Eventually, the paper is suppressed. He'd had to sell his entire library to finance the newspaper. And this is somebody who valued books almost more than life itself. So it's an indication of just how committed he was. About 10 years before, he'd written for the extreme Republican newspaper, Irish Freedom. And he wrote a series of columns which, you know, were eventually published after his death as Principles of Freedom. And they make for a fascinating reading. They really do. Manu, he was a great wordsmith. I mean, he really thought hard about how to craft sentences and how to develop his argument. One thing's for absolutely certain, if the British had read even a small part of that, of those columns of that book, and they had, because these columns were being monitored by the police, they would have known that he wasn't somebody who was ever going to back down. I mean, he absolutely made a point 10 years before the hunger strike, saying that there will come a time when, as it were, the individual is going to be tested. And that individual must spend his time between now and then preparing. And that's ultimately what he does. So McSweeney does not go on that hunger strike believing he was going to be released. I think he genuinely believed that it might necessarily, it might take his life. And he was prepared to do that even before he started the strike. One should also, of course, remember that there was a separate hunger strike ongoing in Cork jail. In fact, which had started a day or two before McSweeney began his hunger strike. A number of individuals, some of them from Cork, from Limerick, from Tipperary, were incarcerated in Cork jail. These are individuals, to a certain extent, have been overlooked. But ordinary rank-and-file members of the volunteers, nothing that would mark them out in the way that perhaps McSweeney had been marked out by his experience and his writings and his philosophy, as it were. But ordinary rank and file members of the volunteers, and every one of them stuck to the hunger strike. Two men that die on hunger strike, Murphy and Fitzgerald. And
that's Jail Cross. They're the old Cross, Cork Jail,
which is now the UCC campus. Mm-hmm. There are some amazing photographs taken outside the jail of demonstrations, sayings of the Rosary. There's also pictures of the whole of Grand Parade, just as densely packed as you can possibly imagine. Again, saying prayers in support of those who are on hunger strike. Practically every factory or place of employment in the city at some point in time during the hunger strikes, both in Brixton, where McSweeney was, and in Cork Jail, they simply down tools and go to mass, again, in terms of expressing their solidarity with what was going on. And you have the Capuchin Order based in Rochestown. Individuals there are Father Dominic, is the chaplain to the Lord Mayor, so he has daily access to McSweeney in Brixton. But they also, along with the regular prison chaplains, go into Cork Jail as well. So these twin hunger strikes are really very difficult experiences. They really are, not just for the, obviously, the individuals who are on hunger strike, for their jailers. The British government made it clear that the warders, the medical officers especially, who had responsibility ultimately for the physical well-being of prisoners, and others. I mean, you have, let's say, the nuns in the Bon Secours Order go in because the prisoners in Cork Jail say, we don't want any prison doctor. We will only accept treatment and care from the nuns. Partly because they simply didn't trust the prison doctors not to do something if they were unconscious or asleep, or to try and slip something in the water or something like this. So it was very tense. The fact that the strikes go on so long, I mean, they both go on for well over 70 days. Nobody really knew how long you could last. Again, I've looked at this. There had been some hunger strikes. There had been, for example, the hunger strike in Mountjoy and Wernham of Scrubs, where the men had gone into well over day 20. But there was a belief that once you got into maybe around the fourth week, that was you could go at any point. Whereas McSweeney lasts, and the men in Cork last in 10 weeks. There had been a hunger strike, as it were, an experiment in America at the end of the 19th century, where a doctor had, in fact, starved himself, had lasted for 40 days and had recovered. And that was often forgotten about. But there were allegations from both sides that, in effect, that they were being surreptitiously fed.
And was Ireland unique in hunger strike being used as a political...
It wasn't unique in the sense that the suffragettes had used it. And even the suffragettes had seen that there had been some places in Russia, for example, the hunger strike had been used. But I suppose it's the history of the hunger strike in Ireland. I mean, going back to Celtic times, there was an element of provision within Breton law that stipulated the form that a hunger strike could take. If somebody had done you wrong, you went and hunger struck on their doorstep, and if they allowed you to die, in effect, your death was they were held responsible. And that tradition was almost unique to Ireland. There was some sort of equivalent in India. Again, this is one of the reasons why Gandhi's hunger strike struck such a chord, because as well, it plays into Indian history. But Ireland is pretty well unique in Europe in having, as it were, that history with regard to hunger strike. W.B. Yeats had written a play about this about 15 years before, so it wasn't exactly a secret. But the hunger strike is just an awful weapon. I mean, it really is. I mean, it degrades, obviously, the people who are inflicting the prison conditions, obviously the individuals who are subject to it. There's a tremendous stress on their family. The British did allow the family pretty well free access to the prison, but I'm not quite sure whether that was necessarily a good or a bad thing, because you could literally see your loved one wasting away before your eyes. And it just goes on so long. Nobody really believed that it could, that any human being could last. And you start then having the deaths, both of McSweeney and the two deaths in Cork Jail, happening basically within a few days of each other. And thereafter, the hunger strike is called off. In one sense, the British had gained a victory because the hunger strike wasn't used again. But the extent of the mobilisation of international and domestic opinion in support of the Republican cause, and the fact that they were seen as martyrs, self-sacrificing martyrs, meant that certainly, as it were, the winners from the hunger strike, without a shadow of a doubt, would have been were the Republican movement.
It's incredible. And all through that period, so it's August 19th is when he's arrested and goes on hunger strike in Brixton Prison. It's October 25th when he dies after the 74 days, with his death galvanising public support worldwide, as you've mentioned. And in between all of that time, there's the burning of Balbriggan. Yes. There are soldiers from the Duke of Wellington's regiment shot dead, the youngest just 15 years of age. One of the ambush party arrested the scene, Kevin Barry, 18-year-old UCD medical student. RIC officers ambushed in Clare, but also, just to bring us back before we maybe move forward again, a tie-in to the late Lord Mayor Tomás McCurtain again, Swansea is tracked.
Yes. I mean, this was a point of honour for the IRA, that Swansea was seen as the individual who was most culpable in terms of those on the immediate scene. The British had made sure to get him out of Cork very, very quickly after both the assassination and then the verdict. But the IRA had their eye on him, and they track him to Lisbon. And he's shot using Tomás McCurtain's own gun. Michael Collins made sure that the deed was done, and when the gun was returned to the family, that was made expressly clear that this gun had killed Swansea.
And they had two efforts at it. Seemingly the taxi broke down first time round. they took the train to Belfast and then commandeered or hired a taxi.
Well, of course, remember that it's you're going into sort of the enemy territory.
Yes.
I mean, Belfast is... Yes.
Is Swansea a Lisburn man? Is he an Irish man?
Well, he's an Irishman. I mean, he's an Ulster Protestant. A unionist, but he would certainly have regarded himself as on the other side of the political divide very, very firmly. But for Corkonians, going to Cork, even going to Belfast in itself, I mean, even now, I suppose the Cork accent stands out in Belfast. In the circumstances of the time, remember, Belfast in 1920 had its own peculiar problems. There are any number of issues, particularly arising from sectarianism, attacks upon Catholic workers in shipyards, and so on and so forth. And then you have the killing of Swansea, and this gives the green light to sort of open season on Catholics, both in Lisbon, in Belfast, and elsewhere.
Well, whatever Catholics were in Lisbon were burnt out and never returned.
Yeah. It was a very heavy toll that was inflicted on the local Catholic community. So all of this is happening pretty much all at the same time. I mean, even Kevin Barry's execution, the first execution under the Restoration of Order in Ireland Act, the British passed a new piece of legislation in the summer of 1920, in effect giving them even greater powers than they already enjoyed under the Defence of the Realm Act, and in particular, in effect, transferring control over almost law and order to the military. Pretty well every offence now, if you sort of litter the street, almost you're subject to a court-martial. There was still some attempt made to hold ordinary courts, but most of those ordinary courts had been subverted by the Dáil courts. So the British were using the military not just simply as an armoured weapon, but as a judicial one, and trying Republicans before them. So that those court-martials had the power to inflict the death penalty, and Kevin Barry is the first casualty. But even there, his death is slightly overshadowed by the fact that it happens on the same day as McSweeney's funeral. So it just gives you an indication of just how incident-packed things are. Of course, what McSweeney's funeral itself was controversial because the body was planned to have been returned to Dublin, and the British, in effect, hijacked the boat, saying, no, it's not. We're not going to have another O'Donovan Rossa funeral. We're not going to have another Thomas Ashe funeral. We're going to dictate the terms by which this funeral takes place. So the body is then shipped to Cork, and you have this very unedifying scene where, in effect, the British land the body, and the body is left on the docks because the family said, we're not going to play ball. You are disgracing yourself. You're interfering with, in effect, a religious ceremony. The British said this was a political ceremony. So you have this sort of appalling scene where the casket, in effect, is left on the quayside for a short period of time.
In Cove, presumably.
No, this is actually in town. The British land the body, the ship pulls into Cove, then there's a small little tender that brings the ship and lands it on the quayside.
And where had the family wanted it brought? Back to Dublin for a full...
For a full-scale funeral. And in fact, what happens is that in Dublin, a mock funeral takes place. A huge turnout takes place, and there isn't even a body there. And this is again, it's very much modelled on the O'Donovan Rossa and Thomas Ashe funerals. And then the British, when the body itself is finally returned to the North Cathedral, the British, in effect, dictate to say there's only going to be a certain number of people can follow the cortege. We're not going to have an open display of weapons by the volunteers as had happened, for example, in O'Donovan Rossa and Ashe's funeral. And they were determined to make sure that the lesson of who was in charge, which, as far as they were concerned, had been demonstrated by the fact that they allowed McSweeney to die on hunger strike, was copper-fastened with the display of force during the funeral itself.
Well, I mean, the story of both podcasts, the idea of who's in charge, I mean, the whole thing is just such a steaming mess.
Yeah.
I watched recently the Michael Portillo show where he looks at this whole period through the eyes of the British papers, and there's talk of all sorts of new characters being brought into Dublin Castle and realising just what a mess the place is, yeah, and how inefficiently the whole thing is being run.
You could not have devised a more inefficient and unfit for purpose structure of government than Dublin Castle had. I mean, you had the Viceroy, the Lord Lieutenant, Lord French, who was very much old school in terms of showing them hard steel. In theory, he was brought in as a generalissimo when he was first appointed. You have a Chief Secretary who, in theory, is the political cabinet member who's responsible, but he has to be in London to answer questions in Parliament, so he can't be in Dublin to experience what is happening day to day. You have a whole series of civil servants, many of whom are plotting and have their own agendas as going on. You have several different, you have the Black and Tans, which in effect are a law unto themselves, the RIC, the Dublin Metropolitan Police. You have the Ulster Special Constabulary, the British in effect militarise, put into a uniform the old Ulster Volunteer Force and call them the Ulster Special Constabularies. You have the British Army. And it is just, and then of course on the other side you then have the Republicans. Remember, on top of all this, the British are introducing, as far as they're concerned, Home Rule. The debate, of course, had moved on at this point, but they introduced the Government of Ireland Act. And not alone are they ignoring the will of the population for a republic, they're now proposing to cut the country in two, something which even unionists can't even begin to comprehend. I mean, it's perhaps a little bit difficult for people to understand that unionists found the partition of Ireland as incomprehensible as nationalists. Unionists and nationalists thought of Ireland in all Ireland terms, because that's the way it had always been. The unionists wanted every part of Ireland to remain within the United Kingdom. They didn't want any part of it to leave, because someone like Edward Carson was a Dublin unionist. I mean, his family was, as it were, on the wrong side of the border. And of course, remember, in Ulster, it's not just Britain, the United Kingdom, that's partitioned with this. It's not just Ireland that's going to be partitioned. Ulster is going to be partitioned. And the Ulster unions were organised on a nine-county basis. So those people who are, as it were, on the six-county side had a bit of explaining to do to the unionists in yes, Cavan, Monaghan and Donegal, why it was that, in effect, they were accepting, with bad grace, but accepting a proposal that put them, cast them into outer darkness and put them under the control of a Dublin Parliament, which was far worse than would have been the case had they come under an all-Ireland parliament, because at least then you would have had the strong Ulster Unionist contingent represented.
Yes.
So
yes.
It was the worst of all possible worlds for the Southern Unionist community, for those in the three remaining Ulster counties, those in Dublin, and of course those in Cork, the strong Unionist community in Cork. They viewed what the government was doing as an utter betrayal of what they had fought for during the First World War. They had said, "We have served King and country. We have fought and died in our thousands, and we deserve to have our loyalty recognised by Ireland being retained within the United Kingdom."
Yeah,
so it's a mess.
Oh, it's a mess because I'm aware of Irish nationalists in the north feeling abandoned by their southern nationalists.
Yep.
As a result of the acceptance of the treaty and the partition of the country.
That comes later.
But it's just interesting to consider the other side of it. The Southern Unionists being abandoned by.
But of course, this
was collateral damage to ensure that the Northern state would be a Protestant state.
Well, it's interesting. That if you have a look, I mean, you mentioned the programme, Michael Portillo's programme. I teach a course in UCC and we have a look at many of the same documents. The original conception of the Government of Ireland Act was you had to give Ireland home rule, but you also had to have partition. But the Conservative Party, who were the ones who were backing it, Walter Long, they were much closer to the Southern Unionists than they were to the Ulster Unionists. I mean, their party was based upon the aristocracy and the landed gentry. And that was a far higher proportion of Southern Unionism than it was the more industrial North, where you had large numbers of working class Protestants and so on and so forth. So the original idea behind partition was that, yes, Ireland was cut in two, but we'll try to make sure it comes back together as quickly as possible, albeit under British control. That we will give Ireland what they want, that Ireland will be governed entirely by Irish men, albeit that Britain will keep a strategic interest in terms of ports and free trade and so on and so forth. But we'll try and make sure that this border, which we've just introduced, is got rid of as quickly as we possibly can. I mean, you're shaking your head, and that's exactly it. It's very, very confusing, the thought that the British, in the very act of introducing partition, many of those who were doing that did it in such a way as they genuinely believed that it would lead to a swift reunification.
Let's settle that little corner and we'll work on the rest.
Part of the idea was that you would have then a 9-county partition. And the idea is that if you had a 9-county partition, reunification was much more likely to be swift than if you had the 6-county partition. It's then only when that decision is taken to take a 6-county partition route, that's when, in effect, partition becomes pretty well entrenched and
hard to get out of.
Yeah, exactly. Very, very difficult.
A noose around the neck, so to speak. It is such a mess of a story. I find it interesting that those who landed arms in 1912 in Larne and signed the covenant in blood, a million of them, to prevent home rule, were the first to get home rule. There's an irony in that.
And of course, remember, many of those are in government. People like Lord Birkenhead, one of the signatories to the treaty, formerly F.E. Smith, Galloper Smith, so named because of when he was galloping around during the Home Rule crisis of 1912 to 1914. And that, of course, was a lesson that the Republicans and the more moderate nationalists were not afraid to point out, the sheer hypocrisy of the British portraying, as it were, the armed resistance to British rule on the part of Irish Republicans as the work of a murder gang, when many of those individuals who were in that government had been prepared to do, in effect, what the IRA and the Sinn Féin had done, which was a unilateral declaration of independence, separation from the United Kingdom, and in effect, potentially sort of allying with Britain's enemies. So the sheer hypocrisy of the actions of people like Walter Long and Lord Birkenhead in particular.
Well, it's also ironic that in showing their loyalty...
Yes, of course.
they were utterly disloyal.
Yes, absolutely. And this is where you start to really get into... If you start following it too far down that rabbit hole,
I suppose it's semantics.
Out.
They would say what was being foisted upon them was not about a loyalty to the Union, but a disloyalty to it. It's very twisted, the whole story. And all through this time, activities are happening across the country. There's a whole head of steam building and you know, reaches various climaxes through 1920. What's happening down in the likes of West Cork?
Well, what happens in West Cork and elsewhere is that reprisals now become sort of a huge part of the story. The British, in effect, had said, well, we've been sitting ducks for so long. We're now going to start, anytime we're hit, we're going to strike back. You mentioned Balbriggan. There are many other instances. Trim in Meath, Knockrockery in Roscommon. And across many of the places, for example, in West Cork, where an IRA attack was launched, the classic reprisal was burning down the local creamery, which, of course, crippled the local economy. And utterly stupid, because it was much more likely to drive people into the arms of the IRA than to separate them, because, in effect, the deed has already been done and you're going to be punished whether you're supporting the IRA or not. And a number of people just simply are driven into the hands of the IRA by that reprisal policy. Now, in fact, this is illegal. I mean, I think the point to note is that these reprisals were illegal. The army and the police had no right, in effect, to start punishing anybody, even wrongdoers, be outside the normal channels of law and order. But so extreme had the position become by late 1920 that the British not alone recognise reprisals, but actually said we're going to have official reprisals. Because part of the problem the British faced is that their forces were becoming ill-disciplined. They were simply ignoring their officers and taking their weapons out and doing what they wanted. And from the point of view of military discipline, the one thing the British feared was that breakdown of the hierarchical control within the army. So the British inaugurate this official policy of reprisals to give some semblance of control, where the officers can tell their men, yes, you're under attack now, but we are under our direction, with our control, with government sanction, you will be going out and wreaking your revenge.
Because the song, you know, "Come out ye black and tans, come out and fight me like a man," refers to the you know, the flying squads. The early, it seems their tactic was to land up in early morning under the cover of darkness, turn places over, take people away.
Well, I mean, they were the regular searchers, as it were, but you beyond that, you had just the. You did have, for example, Michael Collins's house, if you've ever been down there in West Cork, in just outside Clonakilty, that house was burnt down. I mean, they knew who the Republicans were, a pretty standard policy was simply to burn that house down. Michael Collins's house actually was one of the newer houses. They just moved into a relatively recently two-story house, and that's burnt down. And in fact, the family has to move back into the cow shed. It's sort of a little bit similar, I suppose, to the scene which you see in the Wind That Shakes the Barley. So that reprisals, I mean, that's one of the keynotes of the autumn of 1920, along with the hunger strikes, and the British, I mean, really shoot themselves in the foot, because this is absolutely, just because a government says a policeman can go out and burn a house down doesn't make it legal. It was absolutely illegal. So the British government, in effect, had to say, we are sanctioning our armed forces to do illegal things simply because we can't control them otherwise. And it was humiliating for the British. But for the Irish in Britain, of course, they're caught in the middle. I mean, if they are too vocal about what's going on, certainly in the aftermath of what was seen as something like Bloody Sunday, because in Britain, all the attention was on the British soldiers who were shot dead. In Ireland, of course, the attention was on what had happened in Croke Park. But in the aftermath of Bloody Sunday, there was this perception that these gallant officers, decorated war heroes, had simply been murdered in their beds. And this is an example of the depths to which the IRA would plumb. That's how the story was presented in Britain. Of course, the Irish in that circumstance are inevitably going to be on the defensive. But they're still strength in numbers. I mean, and the Irish are there in sufficient numbers, and they tend to live in certain areas in London and in Liverpool and elsewhere. And so they didn't completely hide their light under the bushel. There was a very prominent organisation, the Irish Self-Determination League. Art O'Brien was the president of it. A new biography has just appeared. And he certainly did make his presence and the organisation's presence felt. They were very active in terms of producing copy for newspapers, and giving the presentation of events, as it were, from an Irish perspective.
A tumultuous year, there is no question. We mentioned the soldiers of the 1st Battalion of the Connacht Rangers based in India mutinying over conditions. 61 arrested, 14 sentenced to death, one executed. That man executed was Private James Daly. Firing squad took him out, the last British soldier to be executed for sedition as being one of the leaders of the Connacht Rangers who mutinied over what was happening in Ireland. That was November 2nd. It was a day following Kevin Barry becoming another martyr for the cause of Irish independence, hanged in Mountjoy Jail for his part in the deaths of three British soldiers in an ambush. And it leads up to the Bloody Sunday, as referenced, November 21st, where Collins' squad takes out 14 British agents early in the morning. The RIC and auxiliaries head off to the Gaelic football match in, well, Jones's Road, Jones's presumably, Road, at the time, Croke Park now, Dublin tip on the pitch. And that leads us into the Kilmichael ambush, Tom Barry, who... So that was all going on, by the way. Tom Barry and the West Cork gang are...
Well, I mean, Tom Barry's an interesting figure because...
I mean, is this the moment... Because what I'd be interested in finding out is what was the moment the British realised they were just really dealing with something beyond... they already realised?
Well, the Battle of Kilmichael is definitely a game changer. If you have a look at the cabinet discussion, I can't remember whether it's the following day or 2 days later. The British, and the discussion is there and it's accessible via the British Archives website. And in effect, they're saying this is of a different character to anything that's gone before. This is much more a straightforward military fight. And the IRA got the best of us. I mean, these are individuals, the flying column or the auxiliary company that had been wiped out, were troops who were many years' experience collectively, sort of probably decades of experience in fighting, and they're just simply wiped out. So the British do recognise this as being, in effect, initiating an entirely new phase. So the British response is to declare martial law. In effect, they're saying if this is going to be war, then we're going to allow the army, in effect, to take over everything that it's now civil government is suspended,
which hadn't worked out for them so well post Rising 1916.
Hadn't although
because it was martial law that sentenced.
It was martial law, and they were, but I suppose the British would have said, well, at least they hadn't had another rising sort of in the rest of 1916.
But whereas previously it might have been about coercion and suppression, now they realise, okay, there's a real fight on the go here. But I'd like us to come back to that. We'll maybe look at Bloody Sunday in a little more depth, even though it's not in Cork, but it's an operation run by a Cork man, let's face it, in Mick Collins. And then look at Tom Barry's ambush in Kilmichael between McCroom and Bantry, and as you just alluded to there, the significance of that event. And then, of course, the burning of Cork, which is just such a dramatic story, all in one incredible, crazy year. One thing I wanted to ask right at the beginning, maybe we'll just conclude with this, Gabriel Doherty of UCC History Department, and thank you very much for taking part in the Cork History Matters podcast, episode 2. The RIC decimated by, maybe not desertion, but resignation as a result of what's happening. Are some of the people resigning, well, first of all, I'm sure they shared some of the sympathies for asserting national rights and desires, but would there have been any sense of, you know, smelling what was coming? Would anyone have known that we were 6 months away, you know?
No, I mean, nobody could really have known. I mean, it was very difficult to know what was going to happen the following morning. Yeah. So to try and project further down the line, I'll repeat the fact that the British had introduced this act. As far as the British were concerned, that act was this, that they were introducing Home Rule and they weren't going to go any further. We know now, of course, that they went significantly further a few months later. But up until the very last minute, just before the truce, the British were saying, that's it. I mean, we are dealing with a murder gang. We are dealing with criminals. We don't negotiate with criminals. You simply arrest them or kill them if needs be, but you don't negotiate with them. The British do a 180-degree U-turn over the space of a weekend, which produces the truce and then the negotiations. But nobody could know. Nobody could know exactly where things were going to go. One point, of course, remember is that you did have intelligence being passed to the IRA by some sympathetic elements within the RIC. Most famously, of course, Michael Collins himself recruits a number of figures in Dublin. Remember, you also have a number of some intelligence coming from what is now Collins Barracks, which was then Victoria Barracks. Flory O'Donoghue, who was the intelligence officer for the 1st Cork Brigade, which area covered the city, his future wife was employed as as a typist in the barracks, and she was slipping out the latest signals and missives, basically, I think, through her underwear. The IRA were in possession of many of those messages before the intended recipients had actually received them. And of course, remember that it went the other way. I mean, one of the most controversial aspects of the War of Independence, this happens perhaps more in very late 1920, early 1921, is the perception or the fear within the IRA that intelligence is now starting to go to the British, that you do have informers, and you're now to have a really rapid increase in the number of people being shot and disappeared. That's more late 20, early 1921, but it is a very, very controversial period. And certainly of the entire country, it was the Cork No. 1 Brigade area where the most intense search for informers is ongoing, where the highest number of alleged informers are shot.
Okay, you know what? We'll finish with McSweeney, because this podcast episode was about getting to the heart of that story. The story of his body being left in the casket and deliberately left there, saying that, we're not going to play ball with how you've decided this is going to go. Although they do get to make the calls around the funeral as such. So it's very different to how McCurtain's funeral had been.
Yes.
But up to the North Cathedral, the casket goes. Yes. Only a limited number of people allowed.
Yep. Brought. I mean, and the British are basically in the cathedral. They're making sure there's no demonstrations. They follow the cortege all the way to St. Finbar's.
There'll be no military aspect to this, although there is later.
There is, when after the departure, then you do have an IRA firing party going in. But, I mean, the fact that the British, in effect, felt compelled to intervene in a religious ceremony to that extent, as it further accentuated the religious antagonism which was in existence, that they believe they said, well,
of course they're right, though. I mean, it isn't just a religious, it is political.
Oh, it's
so
political,
their analysis of it, but they're willing to interfere in that realm.
And they said that the IRA would never sort of try to interfere with sort of the funeral of somebody that they had killed. And yet the British, as far as the Irish were concerned, the British had killed McSweeney. The British, of course, said he killed himself. Mm-hmm. But then they compound their actions during the hunger strike by their actions during the passage of the body back to Ireland. I say almost kidnapping the body. I mean, the body is on a boat which is set for Dublin, and the British, in effect, board it and saying, it's not. Mm. I mean, we tell you where the body is going. Mm. And it comes back to that point about McSweeney at the very beginning of the hunger strike saying, I'll decide, it'll be in my hands how this thing is going to go. And in death, as it were, that same philosophy of refusing to recognise British power is continued. And one of the most the first starting point of challenging British power is to, in effect, refuse to acknowledge it. And McSweeney's whole life is, as well, is a tone poem in that direction.
And yet, of course, it's mixed. So they do, but the British do get to call some ways.
No, they do. It's a display of naked military power. That it clearly has no consent of the Irish people behind it. And again, to a certain extent, echoing some of the philosophy of people like Mahatma Gandhi or indeed Martin Luther King, the whole idea behind this type of approach is to reveal the iron fist that's hiding behind the velvet glove.
Gabriel Doherty, thank you so much. I look forward to reconvening to talk a little more on Bloody Sunday, the Kilmichael ambush and the burning of Cork.
Yep, thank you.
What a year 1920 was.
Yes, certainly.
You've been listening to a Red FM podcast. For more extra content, go to redextra.ie.